You are listening to Kubernetes Bytes, a podcast bringing you the latest from the world of cloud-native data management. My name is Ryan Wallner, and I'm joined by Bhavin Shah, coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. We'll be sharing our thoughts on recent cloud-native news and talking to industry experts about their experiences and challenges managing the wealth of data in today's cloud-native ecosystem. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. We're coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. Today is June 22nd, 2022. I hope everyone is doing well and staying safe. So let's dive into it. Bhavin, sorry I had to miss, the last episode we did. Crushed it. Thanks for the shout out at the beginning of it. I did listen to it. But what have you been else?
I don't know. I've been busy. This was the first weekend where we had to mow our lawn, and that's the first life that I've done that. So it wasn't like, again, it was the first time, so it was painful because we had weeds all over the lawn and had the edges had grown all the way up. So it took more time. I'm still waiting for the phase where people say that mowing is kind of therapeutic and meditative. So, it didn't feel like that this time around. So maybe in a few months I'll get into the
phase. Only to some people does it feel that way, Bhavin. You might never get there. Who knows?
Yeah. How about you? What have you been up to?
Yeah, we were down in New York. We had a family member pass away. That's why I wasn't here. So, unfortunately, but at the same time, you do get to see a lot of family during those times that I'm very thankful for. So that's where I was last few weeks. This week, I'm actually traveling. So I'm not even, I said coming from to you from Boston, but I'm in New York. And I'm headed down to West Virginia to do a bit of hiking with a few of my friends. So really excited about the week forward. Maybe, hit a couple barbecue spots. We'll see what else we can do down there. But that's what I'm up to.
Oh, nice. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, no, I'm going to a national park, Bhavin. This is, I feel like I'm following in your footsteps here.
I'm definitely not meeting you, but I'll look for your reviews on how the new national park is. So
yeah, we're just doing a bit that's sort of the northern tip of the Blue Ridge Parkway, which is just only a very small part of it. But I've wanted to do the whole thing. I have to go back, I guess. Great. So before we get into today's topic on InfluxDB, really exciting stuff, and excited to have Rick on, let's talk about the news a little bit. So I have a few things here. The first one I wanted to bring up was there's a really good webinar coming up, community.cncf.io, on Canister, which is part of Kasten's portfolio of products. Canister is actually the piece that you can dig into the specifics around how to do application level data protection. I know we've talked about this many times on the show before, but Canister is actually an interesting way to dive into it if you're new to it, understanding what does application level really mean. Definitely go check that out. Really good webinar.
And if I remember correctly, Canister is an open source project, right?
Like even it though is, like, I believe, yeah. Okay. Unless that's changed, but I believe it is. There's also a really great podcast episode on our on the Google Kubernetes podcast, which is all about cloud native storage. One of the previous employees from StorageOS, previously StorageOS, is on that show and talks all about cloud native storage. So anytime we hear other podcasts talking about cloud native storage, we always want to recommend it. Plus, that podcast is great, so definitely go check that out. We'll put that in the show link. But if you're looking for it, it is kubernetespodcast.com. Pretty straightforward. Yeah. You'll find it there.
I still envy that whenever you look up Kubernetes podcast, they rank higher than us. So we'll get there.
They have the SEO down pat there. So
no, I listened to that episode. It was good. Like they the guy from OnDAT, I did refer to a couple of white papers that the open source community has published around disaster recovery for Kubernetes storage or for Kubernetes stateful application. So
yeah,
that's really another good resource.
Yeah, really, really interesting podcast for sure. The other bit was, I forgot if you mentioned this last week, but I did want to throw a bit. Did you mention the annual report last week?
Yeah, but I highlighted different things. Like I'm looking at the notes right now, and you have something that I didn't even pay attention to.
Yeah, so I won't repeat the annual report, but lots of good information in the annual report. Of one of which I went down a rabbit hole, and I found out more up to date from this week is there's a KEP that's in sort of in progress, and it's the enhancements 3,337, but it's KEP 3333. That's easy to remember. But it's called retroactive default storage class assignment. I wanted to spend just 2 seconds on it because I thought, you know, as a storage and Kubernetes sort of focused podcast, it was actually an interesting problem that they're solving with this KEP, which is, you know, we all understand how storage classes, hopefully at this point, work in Kubernetes. And you have to choose one in order to provision storage, whether that's statically or dynamically. And you can set default versions of that. So if you're just provisioning a volume and you don't specify, you're going to get a default storage class provision for you. Now, there's a little hole, as they describe it, in this workflow, which is if you don't set a default storage class and you try to provision storage, that piece of storage will never be provisioned. It'll just sit there pending. Until you go ahead and set a default storage class and kick the tires on it. That's the key here with this KEP and this change is that even if you set a default storage class after your piece of storage is pending, you have to sort of delete it, the mm-hmm. object, and let it get recreated so that it picks up that default storage class that you've set since not having one. This fixes that in the sense that if you have any that don't have an assignment and would have used a default storage class, when you set it, it'll automatically kick those tires for you, setting off the whole dynamic provisioning of storage from that default storage class. So kind of an interesting problem that you solved. I don't know if you've run into it before. Mm-hmm. I know I haven't run into this before, no. Right? I think most of the time I'm working with storage providers, I'm very clear on which storage class I'm choosing from, but I know a large use case is choosing that default one. So we'll have a link to that KEP in there.
And this is a perfect scenario, right? Where we didn't even know this was an issue until we have a solution for it. So I think that's the perfect way to find out about some tweaks that are missing from the open source like community.
Absolutely.
Okay, I think for me, right, I did have a few funding rounds to highlight and then a couple of news articles as well. So to start with the funding rounds, DataStax, you might know them as the Cassandra company, the AstraDB. I think we had Patrick on one of the podcasts to talk about Cassandra. DataStax, so recently raised a private equity round of $115 million, and which valued the company at $1.6 billion. And I think from a couple of articles that I read, they are looking to focus more on that AstraDB and Astra streaming parts of things. So basically mm-hmm. providing Cassandra as a service, but still using Kubernetes under the covers to host that managed service. So we see this as a growing trend as people are moving more and more, as people are building more and more modern applications and consuming these modern distributed databases. The second funding round was from Platform 9. They raised $26 million. They didn't share details around what round was it or what the new valuation is. But just looking through Crunchbase, I found that this $26 million funding round brings their total money raised to $100 million. And I think they want to spend this money on focusing on go-to-market and some R&D to seek out those larger scale enterprise deployments. I think they are targeting more larger enterprises now with this new funding. So we'll have links for both of those. Then I think the third funding round, which is more from a startup, not from well-known names like DataStax or Platform 9, an Israeli startup called FinOut, they raised a $14 million Series A funding round. Again, no idea on what their valuation is. But another startup that we see in the ecosystem that's helping customers do cost management for their cloud deployments or for their Kubernetes deployment, right? So looking at their website, it looks like if you have FinOut running, you can point them to your Kubernetes cluster and you can get the cost of running individual pods or running an application inside a specific namespace. They can also help you break down your cost into how much does each folder in an S3 bucket or each Snowflake query cost you in your overall AWS bill, for example. So all of this, I think, goes more towards the trend that, people are running these and now they want to make sure that they have optimized their infrastructure. So FinOut is another startup that's trying to go after that space. A couple of additional articles. I know we covered a couple of use cases last time, companies like Coinbase and Airbnb that are using Kubernetes now. Mercedes-Benz, they had an article out where I think end of 2021, they shared some numbers. They are running 900 Kubernetes clusters across wow. four different data centers on-prem. So that's a huge number. The thing that caught my eye was they are using Cluster API and running these clusters on OpenStack. So
probably have to, unless they wanted just to give an arm and a leg for the 900 clusters.
That's true. So I think right now, just reading through the article, right, they do have like five different platform teams with a couple focused on just providing that Kubernetes as a service platform for their engineers. And then there are the three remaining platform teams focused on things like database as a service or providing that logging and monitoring as a service and security, and including runtime registry and image scanning. So they do have a huge organization to support those 900 clusters. Interesting thing was they are looking at AKS and EKS or even running Kubernetes using the same orchestration on EC2 instances. So they are looking at looking to offload some of these clusters or maybe the new ones to the cloud so that they don't have to scale the platform team from like where they already are. So it's an interesting article talking about an actual use case and how they are using it. So we'll link that in the show notes as well.
Yeah, great.
And then the last thing that I wanted to highlight was I think WeWorks had like a GitOps con last week, and one of the interesting announcements that came out of it was through Weave policy, which is what customers can use to set predefined policies and it will test against your clusters. They can now also help you set HIPAA policies. So healthcare customers that are dealing with patient information, which is supposed to be confidential and PII, they can now have these HIPAA policies integrated into Weave policy and have these predefined rules. So they can cover not just a single cluster, but using this policy as a service offering, they can cover multiple clusters and multiple phases. So if they can monitor a cluster that's already running, so application that's already running, so runtime, so running it in audit mode, deploy time, so they can have these policy integrations into the admission controller. So if things don't look right or if things aren't complying, they can basically deny that application from being deployed. And then during development as well, so whenever they are committing something to their repo, they can check against these policies as well. So helping with the shift left methodology. So I think using this, it just felt interesting that now these compliance standards are getting integrated into your CI/CD or GitOps pipelines, where you can just make sure you can just rest assured that these tools will take care of making sure you're compliant. And at the end of the day, you can just generate and download some reports to validate that you were compliant against these standards. So something that's interesting. Again, we'll have it in the show notes if you want to learn more about it.
Great, absolutely. Lots of good news going on. Seems like the end of June, things are really picking up. Maybe that's just me.
Yeah, we are slowing down.
Cool. So, you know, let's dive into our topic. We have a really great guest on today. Today's topic is going to be all about InfluxDB, sort of time series database. We're going to be talking about what is time series, how InfluxDB runs on Kubernetes. And our guest is the VP of products, Rick Spencer from InfluxData. So he's had a previous role, the VP of Influx Data Platform, where he focused on sort of cloud native delivery, CI/CD, high availability, multi-cloud, multi-region deployments, and all things scale. So I'm sure we'll have lots of interesting questions for Rick. And without further ado, let's get him on the show. Welcome to the show, Rick. It's great to have you on Kubernetes Bytes. Let's just jump into about a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Sure. So first of all, thanks so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to this discussion. I'm always love to talk about Kubernetes, geek out on it.
Absolutely.
One way or another. So I'm currently the VP of product at InfluxData, but these are fresh wounds. I was most recently the VP of engineering for the platform team. And during the 2.5, almost 3 years that have been at Influx, we've gone from running one production cluster to running probably over 15. And, you know, we have a huge Kubernetes bill. So we really run Kubernetes at scale in a couple ways. We run really big clusters, and we also run on all three clouds, the big three clouds, I should say. Okay. And we run in multiple regions of those clouds. And we do CI, CD to them, like multiple times a day on a typical work day. So yeah, it's where we're.
So that's what you're up to now. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, you mentioned InfluxDB, and the, probably the good question to answer now is, what is InfluxDB in your own words, I guess?
Right. So we are a time series platform. Of course, we have a time series database at the core. What is time series? Like, the most simple answer I can give you is that's like your time stamped data. And we are able to ingest, process, and support queries of that data at substantial scale. So for instance, the data could be metrics from your Kubernetes cluster or from the nodes that those clusters are running on. A lot of our customers are in the IoT space. They're collecting sensor data. We support nanosecond resolution in that data. And you know, I can go on about the different ways that you can get InfluxDB, but let's just say the probably most interesting for the Kubernetes discussion is that we have something called InfluxDB Cloud. It's a fully managed service that we manage on your behalf, and that runs on Kubernetes. So it's a very stateful database run on Kubernetes, all three of the top clouds in multiple regions.
Okay, that's perfect, because that was one of my questions when you answered the first question, right? Like, that you run on these different cloud platforms. I was like, is it possible that you're running the InfluxDB Cloud on Kubernetes? But thank you for answering that.
Yep. Yeah.
Now, is the fact that you run them on all major clouds, is that just for customer choice, or is that your choice for flexibility? Curious around that.
Yeah. So there's a saying called data has gravity. So that's one of the main elements of it, of the reason that we do that, is if you're collecting terabytes of data, you probably don't want to egress that out of the cloud provider, transfer it across the world to some other cloud provider. Like, if let's say you have a SaaS product that's like your HR system. Mm-hmm. And you're exchanging kilobytes of data, and well, if they're using Node, maybe megabytes, you know, of HTML or whatever. But you don't really care if like that is, you know, in Europe somewhere, and you're in California, and you know, it's just like such a comparatively small amount of data. Mm-hmm. You don't care so much about the latency if you're writing and reading data at the scale that our customers do. They want it in a region that's close to where that data is being produced, so that they can keep the latency low, and in some cases, just reduce their overall cost. So that's why we provide so many options for where to access the SaaS service.
Okay, gotcha. So I think next question that I had was like talking about all the different use cases. I know you mentioned IoT as being one of, or IoT or edge computing as one of those most popular use cases that InfluxDB has. So how does that architecture look like? How does it work with a SaaS service and then data being generated at those remote locations?
Sure. Like, let me break that down for you like real quick. So, let's say you're an IoT vendor and that you're writing a custom IoT application. I'll pick something that one of our customers does, like you're monitoring some specific kind of industrial equipment, right? Let's say a big machine, like a fan or something like that. And that's what you specialize in. So every factory that you work in, or every plant or whatever, let's say, has 10 of these fans, and those fans are millions of dollars. They're covered with sensors. Mm-hmm. You're generating, you know, metrics, you know, multiple metrics per millisecond. If you know, that's, you know, going down to the nanosecond granularity. And then you probably have some kind of embedded device on that, which, you know, is not running Linux. It's just like embedded, it's doing a local control loop. But one thing that you might have on that is this agent that we have called Telegraph, which then is able to take all that data and send it to another InfluxDB location. So Telegraph is an agent that you can install, you can build, put it wherever you want, and it's just great at slurping up data, writing it to an InfluxDB instance. Let's say within that factory, you have a gateway. Like maybe you bought it from Dell or HP or something like that, and you just have this like huge honking computer that's hanging on a rail in the, you know, boiler room or whatever, and you are running Linux on that, right? So then what you can have on there is InfluxDB, OSS. It's totally free. It's our OSS version, and you're just crushing that with all the data from the fans, right? And then there, if you're, let's say you're on the plant floor and you're like, oh, I just got an alert. How did you get that alert? Because what happens is that local InfluxDB instance can be reading all that data, super high resolution. We have a programming language called Flux that runs within that instance, right? Within InfluxDB itself. And it can like detect like the combination of this sensor and this sensor is bad. We should like, page or whatever, however you do the alerts. We can support arbitrarily complex or simple alerts and transformations on that device. We can also do other computations, but we can also serve visualizations and et cetera. So you get the alert, you log into that gateway, you look at InfluxDB, you look at your graphs, and you're like, okay, now I know what's going on. Nothing to worry about here. Okay, and then what you can be doing is like, that's a lot of data that you're collecting, right there. If you care about all the data, that's fine. You can just replicate that. More typical is that you'll use this, another Flux function, which will transform that data and usually, quote, downsample it.
Okay.
By either like aggregating rows, like just give me the maximum reading for this sensor every minute or every second instead of every single, you know, instead of 100 per millisecond or whatever, right? So you can collapse that down, you can aggregate it. You can also enhance or simplify that data. Then you write it to a special bucket, which is replicated. So that it's called edge data replication, which is a feature then that that OSS instance of InfluxDB will automatically replicate that data via a durable queue up to our multi-tenant SaaS. Now, if you are looking at 100 plants, each that have many of these big pieces of equipment, now you can get an aggregated view across all the plants, you know, like that plant got an alert, et cetera. So there, we have two kinds of users, basically. One kind of user is actually building a custom user experience on top of it. And so we have all the APIs and developer tools and et cetera. So their customers don't know that they're using InfluxDB under the hood, right? They just think they're using, you know, whatever the service provider is. We have another kind of customer that is doing operational monitoring at scale, and they're just required to have a custom solution just because of the scale or whatever other requirements that we're working at. In that cloud SaaS version, it has all those features and more. So you get Flux, you get the visualization libraries, you get all the developer tools. Telegraph can talk directly to your cloud account that if you want. On that SaaS version, you know, sometimes you don't have a gateway and you're just writing directly from your devices or from your servers or whatever. You're just writing directly to the cloud. That's fine too. We have a free tier. So if you just want to come in and kick the tires, that SaaS version also is also what we call pay as you go. So it's consumption based. So if you're just starting a company or just starting a project or whatever, you just pay for what you're consuming. So you don't have to like, you know, commit to like a huge license, and you can just use like your department credit card or whatever and spend $5 a month while you're prototyping. And then, you know, if your workload grows to you know, $10,000 a month or whatever, that just means your company is successful. And, you know, so that's an overview from a product perspective, yeah, no, which is my new job. So
that's very insightful. I think, you know, I had several questions come up in my head during that explanation. I thought there was a lot of interesting pieces of that. One of which that I want to key in on is, you know, you talked about sort of the high resolution and sort of nanosecond sort of data. You know, what does InfluxDB do differently to handle that type of resolution from these different sensors or different time series data sets that, say, a typical relational or NoSQL database can't do? Like, why go down the route of looking specifically at InfluxDB?
Right. Why do you need Influx, right? Hey, okay, why don't you just use MySQL or whatever? Yeah. So what people find is that at scale, if you start to try to query across time, you must have a purpose-built time series database. So, for example, we have a function called aggregate window in Flux, which says, like, it takes two parameters, a function on which to aggregate, for example, mean, min, max, medium. You can actually put whatever you want. You know, you can write your own custom function to aggregate. And so it takes a function and it takes a time range, like every hour, every 10 minutes, every second, et cetera. Like, what happens is we have a lot of customers who come over to us from document databases, relational databases, where everything worked at trivial demo scale. But once they hit real scale, they just can't, those queries just start to fall over. They just can't handle it. They also can't handle the ingest. So, sorry, are you interested in, I can peel the onion a little bit.
Ingest is definitely a big part of it that, please go down that rabbit hole.
Okay, so as you are writing data to InfluxDB, it's got a few parts of the data model. So it's got a measurement, which is basically like just to group all these together is my measurement, right? Then you have fields, things like, which are the numerical things that you're sampling that change a lot, right? Yep. Like, so CPU load, unless it's pegged at 100%, it's going to be different every time you sample it. Temperature, vibration speed, like all the different things that you might be sampling, those are called fields. And then there's tags, which is basically metadata. And then, of course, a timestamp. So as you stream that data in, we're very highly optimized to take that data in like big batches. Like, we're not a data lake, right? We don't like, you don't like, you don't have to like save up a whole bunch of data and then give it to us to process. And we notify you an hour later that we're done processing it. Like in real time, we can ingest a huge amount of data. It's usually readable in like a couple hundred milliseconds.
Got it.
And then we take that data and we break it up into just conceptually, I won't go into the zeros and ones, but conceptually, we write it into different tables for you automatically based on the tag set. So what is a tag set? Might be like plant ID, device ID, customer ID, any kind of metadata that you're going to want to go back and look at later. Like if you want to say, you know, show me all of the results by factory or show me all the results for this customer, right? Those are different things that you're going to query on. As we write, we create those indexes and those separate tables to make those come back very fast. And of course, we order everything by time as it gets written as well. Gotcha. One thing that's important to note about that is we're actually schema on write, which is it's a sharp knife. So it's very handy because if you decide that you want to add metadata later or change metadata or add fields or whatever, you can just do it from your client that writes.
Got it.
You know, in point of fact, you can actually tell a bucket, like, I don't want to be schema on write. We call that, you know, an explicit schema bucket, in case you have that, you know, because as I say, it's a sharp knife. If you like add too many tag values or something, you can explode your cardinality and run into trouble.
Gotcha. So, when you're talking about querying this information, right? Can we use like SQL queries or is it through Flux?
Primarily, the language is Flux, and Flux is a query language, but really it's a data transformation language. And another thing to note about Flux is it's a full-on programming language. So we have things like HTTP requests, right? So imagine that you're doing a query and you want to know what is the current temperature outside the factory, right? You can, in your Flux, make an HTTP request to some endpoint that has that, you know, weather service temperature, and then use that in your calculations. Let's say you have a database that has customer metadata. You can do SQL.from, query that external database, then query your time series data, join that information together. And by the way, you can also call a remote endpoint, write to another database. So you can write programming tasks that if you're not using InfluxDB, you have to go to your ops team and say, hey, I need to stand up a VM so I can run this job. And they say, sure, give me a couple of weeks. And then you have to monitor that thing. You have to, you know, make sure it's not failing and et cetera, et cetera. So you can take with Flux, you can take like all of that complexity of writing that application and just hand it off to InfluxDB. And we will run those jobs for you. And we, you know, you can write alerts if they start failing for whatever reason, et cetera. You can build all that operational intelligence like into your InfluxDB instance.
Yeah. Okay. That definitely sounds like a very powerful tool. And I imagine it bodes well for those custom solutions that it sounds like you work with a lot, you know, with various customers. They want to do something very specific. So having this programming language to enable that makes a lot of sense.
I do. I'd like to add a couple things though.
Yeah, please.
Like, so we have, so we're on like 2.3 of the open source product, and you know we have an enterprise product, and you know we have you know the 1.x open source product. We support another query language called InfluxQL, which is sort of a twist on SQL, but that has time series capabilities put into it, and that's really a query language. So if you know, if you're used to SQL or et cetera, that's accessible through the API. That's not accessible through our UI currently. We also are building a new storage engine called IOX, which it's totally open source. You can go try it, run it, and everything. That uses a query engine that is also open source that we're one of the top contributors to and maintainers. It's called Data Fusion, and that is a pure SQL query implementation. So if you invite me back to this podcast next year, we'll be able to talk about our full-on SQL support and things that will build on top of that also.
Yeah, we'd love to have a follow-up for sure. Well, I want to switch gears a little bit and kind of direct us back towards Kubernetes a little bit. And it's sort of a twofold question, which is, you know, when you started running Influx on Kubernetes for your own managed infrastructure on the different cloud providers, which you mentioned earlier, what, you know, fundamentally changed for the company? As, you know, was there any strategic sort of path you took that you know, enabled you to do different or more interesting things because you were using Kubernetes? And the second part of that question would be, you know, do you direct people mostly to use that managed service versus, you know, having them run InfluxDB on, you know, their own Kubernetes infrastructure?
Those are two really different questions.
Yes, two very different questions.
Start with the first one. So like using... So first of all, we were very early to Kubernetes. So like we, unfortunately, in many ways, we're trailblazers. And
you take the brunt of it. That we're thankful of.
Yeah. So, but it did allow us to, we call it the cloud abstraction layer, right? So it did allow us to be able to support multiple cloud providers, mm-hmm. right? And to be able to take this thing and run it in different places. We used a system for that, which was a combination of JSONnet and kubeconfig or kubecfg, which I had worked with the authors in, you know, previous life of those projects, or at least the maintainers. And so that allowed us to templatize the deployments at different levels. Right. So we could have like a date-based deployment, then have like on top of that, like a JSONic configuration mm-hmm. that said like modify the base deployment, one for each of the cloud providers that we support. And then with even within the region, then we could add more configuration on top of that, like this region do that, and et cetera. And so that cascading config allowed us to separate the service development and the configuration, which, you know, really, especially in the early days, was like really useful just because we just weren't at the scale that we are mm-hmm. now. And sure. so like how to deal with like noisy neighbor problems and that kind of thing was a bit harder, just because, you know, we just simply didn't have a scale to avoid all that. And it allowed us to also like experiment, you know, to like, hey, let's add a service just here mm-hmm. and just kick the tires on that. And, you know, like, so we've done some experiments where like, you know, what if we have this crazy service and it's just a matter of adding that service configuration to yep. the right file, which, by the way, I don't know if you saw our talk at in Valencia at KubeCon, but that is also a very sharp knife. but yeah, so it just gave us that like ability to really to move fast and try things. And when you paired that with our CI/CD system, which is GitOps based, then that allows us to just have a system where somebody can change code or change configuration by just pushing code or configuration changes into the Git repositories. And then it can be as targeted or as broad as you want to target that.
Okay. That so, change. Rick, before you answer the second part of Ryan's question, right? Yeah. I have questions specific to the cloud deployments. So are you consuming like managed services from each of these vendors for Kubernetes, or do you run these on just cloud VM-based instances and have a different orchestration yeah. layer like a Terraformer?
So to begin with, we like got our own VMs and installed our own, mm-hmm. et cetera. Yeah. But now we run on the cloud providers' default Kubernetes, like EKS, sure. AKS,
okay.
which is problematic because they do not support the same things. They are not on the same versions. Google comes along and says, oh, by the way, we're going to upgrade all of your, you know, nodes with the new Kubernetes version. And you find that out, as we discovered, if you happen to be doing a deployment when that happens, your code isn't necessarily like well-behaved in those circumstances, you know? So there's like those, did like that won us. There's a lot of win there because now we're not managing Kubernetes ourselves, mm-hmm. but that actually injected a bunch of complexity. So we also consume other services like information that's not time series data. Mm-hmm. We keep in Postgres. That we don't manage our own Postgres. Sure. We use, you know, the cloud providers compatible Postgres, for example. There's some places we want to do that more of, but just because like when we started, there weren't necessarily ways to do all these things. We built a lot of our own things that are a bit harder to migrate away from, but we plan to. So yeah, we're very supportive of using the underlying cloud providers' implementations of common services. Like, if I were doing it, if I were to make a recommendation to somebody, I would just like, don't spin up your own Kafka, don't spin up your own Postgres. Like, yep. Going further, I would say, like, use Noble 9 for your SLOs, use Edge Data for your log management. Like, anything that you can offload onto another provider, do it. So then you can just stay focused on, like, your code, your value add. And
yeah. So that's really important, right? Because I think Jeff Bezos said this, right? That don't only focus on things that actually makes your beer taste better. And he was referring to, like, the breweries in Europe in, like, the 1800s, where they had to run their own power grids, which didn't make that beer taste better. And then eventually there were breweries who set themselves apart and stopped managing the power infrastructure and just focused on making the beer taste better. So I think that analogy works here perfectly.
I like that. Yeah, that's good. And I think that there's, you know, one thing is, like, we talk about the cloud service providers, mm-hmm. Services, which is good. But I think what I really recommend people to do is to really recommend, to the degree possible, like, just opt into the community of third-party vendors who are not aligned with a cloud service provider, who are not aligned with, like, a big vendor. Like, there's, like Replicated, if you need, like, a solution for mm-hmm. on-prem or whatever. Like, Replicated has no motivation to, like, get you to buy other services or lock you in or make it harder to, like, use other infrastructure, et cetera. Like, I already mentioned Noble 9, already mentioned Edge Delta. You know, if you want to get to a marketplace, like, look at a company like Tackle.io, who will help you get to all the marketplaces. And, you know, like, they create an abstraction that keeps you from getting locked in. So I think there's this community of companies that are kind of in a second wave of vendors, like people who have managed Kubernetes and built things on top of Kubernetes, and then are solving problems for Kubernetes users like us, but not from the perspective of, like, hey, we're, like, a vendor trying to lock you in or direct you down our, you know, whatever our upsell is, yep. or whatever our lock-in is, et cetera. So that's, like, I'd really strongly recommend that people outsource as much of that as possible and try to opt into that community of providers to the degree possible.
And some of these names are new to me, so I'll definitely, like, look those up, because, as you said, right, as much as we can offload, that's better.
Yeah.
Going back to Ryan's second question, right, like, if customers want to not consume the managed service but run InfluxDB Enterprise, I think, in their own data center environments, do we still need Kubernetes, or that's just running on Linux virtual machines?
So that case that you're self-managing, that's really your option. So we provide different ways for you to install and manage that software. One way is we give you a Helm chart, and you can install the Helm chart in your Kubernetes environment. But we give you other orchestration formats that predate Kubernetes. We have Terraform templates. Honestly, a lot of people just go and wget the binaries and apply the licenses and run the scripts to configure it, you know.
So. Okay. At that point, it's pick your own poison, right? Whatever they are comfortable with.
I mean, that's the whole point, right? Like, if you can't use a multi-tenant SaaS and you have to manage on-prem, then you're already, like, you know, locked into whatever requirements led you down that path anyway.
Gotcha. Makes sense. So one more question. While I was getting ready for the episode, right, I saw that InfluxDB can also help me with Kubernetes monitoring. Like, if I want to use it to monitor what's happening in my cluster, we have seen customer deployments where there are customers who are running more than 100 nodes per Kubernetes cluster. And how can, like, InfluxDB help them with getting that information in real time?
So there's a couple of approaches, and the first is just we have like Prometheus scrapers just built mm-hmm. in, and so if you use the Prometheus library to write out those metrics. You can just scrape those in into InfluxDB. You can just scrape it into your cloud account, set up all your monitoring, everything that you want to that way. A new approach, which I think people are going to start adopting, but I don't know if anyone has yet, I'd be really interested to see, is akin to that IoT edge scenario I was talking about, where, you know, if you have multiple Kubernetes clusters, you can run a OSS instance inside that cluster, process all the data that's been written. Oh, we have a tool called Telegraph that I think I alluded to before, that agent. One of the main things that people do is actually there's a Helm chart, they install Telegraph in their cluster, and then that can then grab all those Prometheus metrics as they're being generated and send them to wherever they want. So one of the things that I think people should look at is to send that data to a local OSS instance running inside the cluster, and then do just what I said about IoT, like all that high fidelity data, throw it away with a retention policy if it's more than an hour old or whatever, but downsample it, process it, replicate it back to your like primary cloud account so you can, you know, look over it. With those flux tasks, you can do interesting things. For instance, you can like have like the high fidelity data, say, just in the cluster with like, say, a 1 hour retention policy. And then if you detect an anomaly, say, okay, actually sync all that high fidelity data back to the cloud. And so that way, if, you know, the whole goes down and reboots and everything, you'll have the high fidelity data. And if you need to do an RCA later or whatever, you can go back and look at the details.
Okay. So, that's a really cool approach, right? Like we don't have to store everything, but then if there is an event that needs to be looked at, there is an option to like ship all that high fidelity or higher resolution data back to that instance.
Yeah. And if you're like, so that's for metrics. If you want to do the same thing with logs, like take a look at Edge Delta. Like they're a really cool company that like, that does something similar to what I just described.
Gotcha. Okay. I think this has been a lot of great information. Thank you for diving into like how Influx helps customers and then how you like use Kubernetes to run your managed services as well. I think I have one last question, like, how can people get started with InfluxDB, the OSS version? I know you already mentioned that, but like, are there any easy ways to learn more about InfluxDB and then get started with it in their environments?
Sure. It's like, we have a lot of great documentation. Probably the easiest way to get started is just to go to InfluxDB Cloud. Just go to our website, influxdata.com. There'll be a link there. Just click the button, create a cloud account, totally free. And then we have some tools there that'll help you set up your developer tools. Like we can walk you through to set up your Python or your JavaScript or your Golang environment. And you can just do all that for free. And like within 20 minutes, you can be reading and writing data and just like experiencing like time series and what it has to offer. So start with a free tier cloud account and then take it from there.
Yeah, that's easy enough. Awesome. Is there anything else that you wanted to highlight before we call this off?
Oh, geez, I don't think so. I'm sure I'll think of it 10 minutes from now. But hey, I really appreciate you having me on the podcast and I really enjoyed the questions.
Yeah, thank you so much for being a guest on the pod, right? And we'll definitely reach back out next year when you have that update up and running.
Sounds great.
Yeah, thank you so much. Looking forward to meeting you in person, maybe at KubeCon North America.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Yep. Thank you so much, Rick. Yep.
Bye.
All right. Well, it was great having Rick on the show. I don't know about you, Bhavan, but I haven't done a ton with time series data. I know it's, you know, a lot of the data out there from, you know, different sources is really time based if you really think about it. So really interesting solution to dive into with Rick here. You know, one thing I wanted to note was sort of the choice of their managed service and how it sort of evolved over time, right? Because they were early to this sort of whole Kubernetes ecosystem. And, you know, you mentioned at first,
you know, they were deploying their own virtual machines and deploying Kubernetes and sort of, you know, having to manage all that. And now as, you know, this ecosystem has matured, as we've seen over the years, you know, they're going with sort of the cloud provider versions of Kubernetes. And, you know, one might think that makes their lives a lot easier, but, you know, to his point of view there, that it comes with its own challenges, right? Mm-hmm. You have to be aware of when those versions of Kubernetes go, out of use, and they get automatically updated, or if you're doing certain things while those updates are happening, or, you know, being aware of what they support or what they don't support. So, you know, just a really interesting kind of real world use case of, you know, the pros and cons, of using sort of your own pre-built infrastructure versus, you know, something managed. And, you know, to his point of view, it really sounds like their focus as a company really is to focus on their own innovations. And So, you know, we've heard this in the past where managed services really do allow you to kind of refocus your efforts where you want to, right? Offload the operations and management of something else. You know, he mentioned a bunch of them, you know, not just Kubernetes, but specific databases or data services that they're using. So I thought that was an interesting point.
I know. And I think for me, right, one takeaway was just the way we did this episode. I think it was interesting to see how InfluxDB and time series database can help customers with different use cases, especially the IoT use case, right, where all the high resolution or high fidelity data is available on site, but then you aggregate that or you up-level that and then send only aggregated information to the SaaS platform. So that was an interesting, like, new approach of, like, thinking about use cases. And then I did like the fact that, okay, they're running on Kubernetes in the public cloud. Yes, but then if customers still want to own everything, even own the control plane, they have solutions. Eric mentioned they have, like, Helm charts. They have just simple Linux binaries that you can download. They have the agents like that you can run on your Kubernetes cluster itself. So different ways you can get started with InfluxDB. And I think since they have been using Kubernetes for a while, they have figured out what are the best delivery mechanisms for these on-prem components as well. So I think it was a good balance between how they are consuming it, what were the challenges, how they evolved their SaaS-based offering, and then what their on-prem looks like, on-prem solution looks like as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So, you know, I think that brings us to the end of this episode on InfluxDB. You know, I really enjoyed tackling this sort of specific topic, and we'll look forward to next week. I'm Ryan.
I'm Bhavin.
And thanks for joining another episode of Kubernetes Bytes. Thank you for listening to the Kubernetes Bytes podcast.